Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, when does democracy have a dark side? Our guest says that majorities can and do oppress minorities in the name of majoritarian democracy. And first, since 2020, many states have passed legislation making it more difficult to vote. Fears of voter suppression and the disenfranchisement of marginalized communities proliferated the 2022 midterms. Were those fears realized? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. In the aftermath of the 2020 U.S. election, several states passed legislation intended to make voting more difficult in the U.S. Democrats in Congress attempted to counter this campaign, but the filibuster in the Senate blocked any meaningful legislation. So this past Tuesday, the U.S. voted in its midterm elections under fears that voter intimidation, voter suppression, and other ways to block voting would undermine democracy and disenfranchise voters. Now, with this admittedly very early analysis, as of this recording, neither House of Congress has been determined. The control of the House of Congress has been determined. We will explore the impact of these laws on voter turnout, on the outcome of the election, and what this means for future elections going forward and the future of voter empowerment and enfranchisement as a fundamental principle of democracy. Our panel today is Bertrell Ross, Justice Thurgood Marshall, Distinguished Professor of Law and Director of the Karsh Center for Law and Democracy at the University of Virginia. He's the author of Voter Data, Democratic Inequality, and the Risk of Political Violence, Passive Voter Suppression, Campaign Mobilization, and the Effective Disenfranchisement of the Poor, and Partisan Gerrymandering as a Threat to Multiracial Democracy. Dan Tokaji is the Fred W. and Vi Miller Dean and Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin Law School. He's the author of Truth Threats, Voter Intimidation and the Constitution, Election Law, Democracy, and Legal Education, and the co-author of Election Law, Cases and Materials. And Jeremy Suri, Professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs. He is the author of the very recently published book, Civil War by Other Means, and is the host of the podcast, This is Democracy. Thank you all very much for joining us. Professor Ross, I'll start with you. There was this campaign after the 2020 election to make voting more difficult in several states. How much of an impact did those laws have in those states in this 2022 election?
Thanks for the question and thanks for the introduction. I would say we had about 20 or so states that passed restrictive voting laws after the 2020 election. And those decisions were based in part on the big lie, the idea that the election in 2020, the presidential election, was stolen, that was propagated or and put forth by Donald Trump. And those restrictive legislation laws were put forth in states like Georgia, Florida, Arizona, states where Republicans controlled both houses of the legislature. But you also had some states that passed more expansive laws that made it easier to vote. And so you had a bit of a cross current going with respect to voting laws over the last couple of years. We just don't know yet what the effects were of those laws, just like we don't know who controls either House of Congress at this point. We do have some anecdotal preliminary evidence that turnout was quite high. And I attribute that to a variety of factors. This was an election of high interest due to the Dobbs decision, which mobilized quite a few voters. There's also some economic pain that people were experiencing with inflation. And there was a rather robust ground game in the states. And so there's a lot of mobilization activity that was taking place in the states, more so than you've seen in previous midterm elections, because there's just a lot more money put into this election. And so to the extent that there were these laws that were restricting the votes, you had these counter-mobilization efforts that were designed to inform the voters about the laws and the limits and what they have to do to register and to vote. And I think that limited the effect, neutralized the effect of some of these restrictive laws. But I was a little worried. One of the set of laws I was most worried about were those laws that allow for greater election interference by, you know, partisan actors in both voting and the vote counting process. And when I saw the images from Arizona with respect to vigilantes at the polling places in full military tactical gear, and there were some reports out of Texas that voters feeling intimidated when they went to the polls, that was very worrisome to me. So I think we just need to wait. The turnout numbers were good and strong for a midterm election, but I think we need to wait and see what to assess what the effects of those restrictive laws were.
And Dan Takagi, Rachel Ross had referenced this question about voter intimidation. I know you've written explicitly on questions of voter intimidation. Was there a lot of evidence of voter intimidation? Or I know some of these counter strategies try to counter some of these campaigns. They're at least apparent and potentially successful.
Professor Ross really had it exactly right. And the same thing that he said about vote suppression laws really applies to voter intimidation as well. It's just really hard to say. And, you know, there was a great paper on this subject in the Election Law Journal that I believe came out in 2009 by Robert Erickson and Lorraine Minaiti. It was specifically focused on voter ID, but talking about why it is so hard to measure the impact of voter ID laws, which even at that point in time, we were seeing proliferating in the states. And it remains the case to this day. You know, there are just so many things that can affect turnout. It is really hard to measure in a reliable way the overall impact on turnout or the partisan impact. I do think if we go back over this period of time, roughly going back to 2005, 2006, when we saw the first really restrictive photo ID laws and in the states of, it was Georgia and Indiana first, and proceeding through the various restrictions we've seen on absentee voting, on voter registration, voting purges, all sorts of laws. And of course, that has intensified, as Professor Ross mentioned, since the 2020 election. You know, I don't think these laws have had as much of an impact from what we can measure as I thought they were going to have when they first started appearing 17 years ago. I really thought this might be something that would have a huge impact on how many people turn out to vote and a huge partisan impact. I think they probably do have some impact, but not as much as I would have thought back then. And back to Bertrand's answer, I'm really much more concerned about these more recent laws, like what we've seen in Georgia, by way of example, that shift authority over who's running elections. You know, I think it's helpful to distinguish vote suppression, or what I've called the new vote denial on the one hand, from election subversion, from like changing who's responsible for running elections. And at the moment, I am much more worried about election subversion, particularly given the election denialism that we've seen over the past couple of years. Though I do remain concerned about vote suppressive laws too.
So many of the races with these high profile races were Secretary of State races. It's striking to me just how close a number of those races actually were. There's a bit of a sense that maybe if we did dodge a bullet, we barely dodged a bullet, and these are going to continue to rise. And if the reason why the voter intimidation or some of these laws weren't as effective is because so many people were pretty emotional at wanting to ensure that they vote because of those laws, should we be concerned that that's not going to continue then going into the future? Because there's one thing about the immediate election after that. What about the next and the next and the next?
I'm really very concerned about this. And I do think, you know, there's some good news, at least preliminarily, from the 2022 general election. It does look like a lot of the most strident election denialists lost, including particularly candidates for Secretary of State's office, which in most states is the election that's the office that's responsible for overseeing and running elections, and governor's offices, which have some authority for certifying the presidential vote. So I think that's really good news. And a lot of down ballot candidates as well also seem to have lost. But I think it would be premature to declare victory over election denialism and the concomitant risk of election subversion, right? I mean, it has been actually good to see even some of the election denialists conceding defeat after the election, right? Which, you know, is not a sure thing. Democracy really depends upon the losers ultimately accepting the result, even if they don't agree with what happened. And we do seem to be seeing that in this election, but it is a continuing worry. I am especially concerned with all the state and local election officials who've been saying, in the face of all these threats and intimidation they face, enough is enough. I'm going to do something else. And who's going to be replacing those people? This is a kind of under the radar issue that could really affect future elections.
Jeremy Suri, you're the historian on the panel. This new book that you've written emphasizes another period of attempts to try to expand the vote and a pretty intense anti-enfranchisement campaign at the end of the Civil War. How much is what we're experiencing in the most recent years and these voter suppression pretty consistent with the American historical record on the expansion of the vote and the reaction against that expansion?
I think it's very consistent with our history, and our history matters because the past experiences that have often been normalized, accepted, they justify and legitimize the use of those same behaviors today. So the language of fraud, which is used extensively, pioneeringly in the 1860s and the 1870s, is used basically to target people who are thought to be the wrong people who are voting: African-American voters, Jewish voters, Catholic voters in the North. And that language of fraud is used in an almost identical way today. And the fact that it was used for so long in some parts of the country, that language was used through the 1950s. Even in my own Austin, Texas, you can find evidence of people saying it was fraudulent for certain people to vote in the 1950s. So the presence of that language in recent memory and the presence of that language in our culture, it provides a plausibility for its usage. The same is true for political violence. As I talk about in my book, political violence is deployed very specifically and in an organized way throughout the country in the two decades after the Civil War. And we have seen that in the last 6 years. What happened on January 6th was an organized political insurrection. And the gentleman who broke into Nancy Pelosi's home when he was deposed by the FBI, his affidavit is available on the web for anyone to read. He said he wanted to break Nancy Pelosi's knees and wheel her into Congress so other members of Congress would know there were consequences to their action. In my book alone, there are about six different times when people say almost the same thing in the 1870s. We don't recognize how much political violence has remained a part of our system and how the rule of law is often deployed unequally to protect certain actors and to basically discriminate against others. That's still part of our system. And I'll just say that the one state where I do think we can see this already, prima facie at least, operating in this election in 2022 is in Texas. Most of the country did see pretty good, pretty high turnout, comparable to 2018, the last midterm or higher, except for Texas. And there were a number of measures taken by the Texas legislature in the last few months that made it harder for people to vote. The most significant one being that they did not allow temporary voting locations for early voting. They made it harder for a location to be a location used for voting. And they also made it harder for universities to have voting. So here at the University of Texas, we actually did increase the number of voting locations. But Texas A&M and College Station had zero voting locations on its campus, and most universities lost voting locations. And so Texas had a lower turnout among young voters than other states did, and that's why.
And actually, Jeremy, I want to follow this up then, because I know that there's been discourse about the availability of these voter centers on college campuses, and a sense that the college students don't really deserve the right to vote. Sometimes the framing of that is, well, they're not really residents here, they're temporary, and if they're going to vote, they should vote by absentee. But then there's the campaign to make it more difficult to vote by absentee anyway. And even I happen to see on social media a number of conservative commentators saying, well, shouldn't we consider raising the voting age to 21. Am I making too much of this, or is this part of this same consistent idea that there's deserving voters and fraudulent voters?
Well, it's part of a very old story. And of course, I'm going to say that as a historian, right? Our country is moving in two directions now, as it was in the 1870s. The 1870s, you see remarkable efforts, and many successful, by new communities, African-American immigrant communities and others, to participate. And you see a backlash against that. And you see that exactly today. It is crazy to say that 18 and 19-year-olds should not have the right to vote. Who has more of a stake in the future of our society? My son, who just turned 18, for a few years he was quite upset he didn't get to vote as a 16-year-old. And his argument was, he's 16. The future of this country is actually going to affect his life more than the 85-year-old who votes. And why is the doddering 85-year-old, I won't say doddering when I'm 85, but why is the doddering 85-year-old more knowledgeable of the issues than an aware 16-year-old? And in Texas, I've seen this argument that students shouldn't have special privileges to vote. No one's asking for special privileges. We're just asking for them to have access to be able to go and vote. Let me give another example, though. Harris County, which is one of the largest counties in the United States, it's the county that surrounds Houston. It's one of the most diverse counties in the United States, so it's more diverse than New York City. Harris County had 24-hour voting in the last election because the largest employer in Houston is not the oil industry, it's the medical facilities. And there are lots of nurses, Filipino nurses and others, who work all day and can't vote regular hours. So they had 24-hour voting. There's no evidence of any fraud. The Texas legislature prohibited 24-hour voting. There are 24-hour gun shops, but there's not 24-hour voting. Who are they targeting? Why is that being done? And then you must ask why we still have such low turnout in Texas. In fact, lower than in 2018. Most other states had higher turnout. And the answer is old-style voter suppression.
That, by the way, is a constant complaint of mine, that I believe the U.S. is the only advanced industrial democracy that votes during a workday. But everybody else, either you get the day off or it's the or it's a weekend where people are traditionally not voting.
And the history is clear that was done to actually make it difficult for certain people to vote, and we've never moved out of that.
Mm. Which is a great transition, Bertrand Ross. I know you've written about the role of what you call passive voter suppression. A lot of what we've been talking about is rather active voter suppression. But would this be an example of a passive voter suppression to schedule elections when the working class can't get off work?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an aspect of it. I think a part of it in terms of making it more difficult to vote is has to do with the limitations on access to the polls, but also limitation on information that's relevant to voting, right? And so with respect to the information barriers, they come in multiple forms. There's absence of information about the candidates that's available to people, or the information that they're receiving is a very limited piece of information that limits their ability to differentiate between the candidates. Lack of information about the issues, lack of information about how to vote and the logistics of voting. And that has been the biggest issue in recent elections, in the sense that there are laws that are changing by the year, by the month, that change how you vote. And therefore, people have to kind of update their knowledge, but they have limited access to the information that will allow them to update their knowledge on how to vote. And so we rely extensively on get out the vote campaigns and nonprofits and political parties to fill in that gap. And what's happened in states like Florida is that they've tried to limit the ability of nonprofits to engage in sort of canvassing and get out the vote efforts that would inform the public. And so the chief concern with respect to passive voter suppression is again, the constraints on information that individuals are receiving about voting that has an effect on their turnout. One study showed from back in 2000, and it's been consistent with more recent studies, is that when a campaign goes to your house to tell you about the election, whether it's the logistics of the elections, the issues, or the candidates, you're 8 to 10% more likely to vote than if they don't. And campaigns don't have unlimited amounts of money, and therefore they make decisions about who they're going to reach out to. And what campaigns have decided to do is they've decided to target those who have voted in prior elections under the assumption that they're more likely to vote in the current election. And who that leaves out are those who haven't voted in prior elections, those who are more marginalized, and therefore often need the more information to know how to vote and what the issues are. And so part of the passive suppression issue has to do with, you know, that information dilemma and the lack of access to information. And if we made voting easier, made it more accessible, made it on weekend days, did other things, that could help address the information gap, because these things about how to vote would be easier to come by. But they kind of play and they interact with each other in troubling ways. And so we celebrate this turnout from this election, but we're looking at turnout that's around 50-55%, right? And I know that that's good for a midterm election, but we have to reflect on the fact that there's 40-45% of Americans who did not vote in this election. And the question we need to be asking ourselves is why? And what we see also is a gap between the rich and the poor with respect to voting, a 30% gap that has consistently existed, persisted over the last 50 years. And we need to think about what the reasons of that are. And because if we have marginalized people in our polity, you know, they're more ripe for recruitment by anti-democratic authoritarian leaders, because they've been sort of, you know, left out of the system, and they may have less belief and less attachment to the democratic system that we have. So those are things to reflect on that, you know, I'll be looking for the data to see how, you know, those barriers and lack of access to information may have impacted turnout.
And Dan Takanji, thinking about this as well, I don't know if this, the legal implications, the political implications, one of the ways to address what Bertrand Ross just highlighted, a number of countries mandate voting that's never been terribly popular in the United States. Are there any legal hindrances? If we had a campaign that would just, you know, mandate voting with a small fine that would be attached if you don't vote, and then how important would that be at altering some of the political discourse?
Yeah, it would be very interesting to see. You know, the people who don't vote are different from the people who do vote, especially as Professor Ross just mentioned with respect to socioeconomic status and education. And that's where you really see huge disparities between who votes and who doesn't. So compulsory voting, a number of countries have it. There are varying degrees of enforcement, but there, you know, as you would expect, there is evidence it does increase turnout and the representativeness of the electorate. We have a strong libertarian tradition in this country. I can certainly imagine legal challenges that might be mounted if a state tried to enact compulsory voting. You know, it's really an untested issue in the United States since we haven't had it. But I would love to see a state or local jurisdiction try compulsory voting, see what the impact is, both on total turnout and the representativeness of the electorate. I guess my personal view is it should probably be upheld, at least against any federal constitutional challenge, though I am sure we would see legal challenges to such laws if they were ever enacted.
And Jeremy, sir, I'd love to get your thoughts on that as well.
I think mandatory voting makes a lot of sense. I'm not a legal expert, as my two colleagues are here on the call, so I'll defer to them on the legalities of it. But what I think is crucial about mandatory voting is it turns the presumption around. If you have to vote, then you can't take all kinds of measures to prevent someone from voting. We all have to write a tax return every year. And so no one has any justification in preventing us from actually submitting our 1099, our tax return. The same would be true for voting under that situation. And so the state would have an obligation, an affirmative obligation, to help me to vote. They could have all kinds of ID requirements, but then they would have to help me to get the ID to prove that I have the right to vote. It would eliminate this entire debate. And so when people say to me that they think we're exaggerating voter suppression, I say, put your money where your mouth is. Just make it mandatory for everyone to vote. And then we don't have this discussion. We don't have this debate anymore. And it should be said, no one would be forced under that system to vote for a candidate they don't want to vote for. You can show up, as you do in Australia, I believe, and vote for none of the above. All we're saying is that you have an affirmative duty as a citizen to fill out a tax return, to register for selective service, and to vote every time we have an election. That's all. And it seems to me a very sensible way out of this problem.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the voter suppression laws and the impact on the 2022 midterms and beyond with Bertrand Ross of the University of Virginia, Dan Takanji of the University of Wisconsin Law School, and Jeremy Suri of the University of Texas. The Australia case seems to suggest that one of the positive benefits of the mandatory voting is it seems to actually be pretty effective at getting some of the money out of politics. That if you know everybody's going to have to vote, and certainly all the money that goes into the get out the vote campaigns, that you have to vote, you don't need to spend that money on the get out the vote.
Doug, if I could say that there also, it would eliminate, I apologize, Bert, for stepping in, but it would also eliminate the money in voter suppression. Let's be honest, much money is spent to send out disinformation. Money is spent to divert people. And so that money would also be saved.
And Bertrall, you're going to respond as well.
Oh, no, I was just thinking about in terms of that mandatory voting combined with public financing systems, which is also a combination that we've seen in several Western countries. And I think that, you know, with that combination, it money is a valuable tool in election in terms of getting information out there. Right. And so but the problem, of course, is when we have a private financing system, there's risk of corruption that are associated with it. So public financing, of course, allows for information to get out there through the use of money. And when you combine it with mandatory voting, right, you could create a system that's fully inclusive and, you know, limit some of the corrupting effects that we have in our American system of democracy.
And actually, Professor Ross, I want to follow up on something you were talking about, the information question, the lack of information being a form of passive voter suppression. I know there's been a lot of emphasis on misinformation. The tendency has been on these kind of spectacular misinformation campaigns and social media, you know, conspiracy theory elements. But I wonder how much common misinformation. We spend so much money on ads. And it seems that in particular, if you're basing your choice on candidates, propositions, et cetera, on the ads, they seem to be particularly misinformed. Does that have an impact on voter turnout? And it certainly seems, I would imagine, has an impact on, shall we say, effective or accurate descriptions of voter preference versus who they're actually voting for.
Oh, absolutely. I think the most pernicious form of misinformation or disinformation are those that have to do with the logistics of voting. There's the classic stories of leaflets left at the doors of people in minority communities telling them the wrong place to vote, or telling them that they can't vote, or telling them that election day is on the wrong day. There's now, you see this, a lot of this occurring through social media channels right now, in which, you know, people are misinformed and misinformed about the election. But there's also the problematic misinformation about the issues, and that leads to these conspiracy theories and these false beliefs about democracy, the candidates, the issues. What this has the effect of doing is it really makes it challenging for individuals to vote according to their preferences. They may have a set of preferences and wants out of their politicians, but they can't get a clear sense of who might represent those interests. And so therefore, they either do one of two things. They end up voting rather randomly on the basis of the misinformation that they have, or they don't vote at all because they're just too bombarded with information that is not correct, but they can't quite make sense of. And that's where the education gap comes in with respect to voting. Those with greater education have often the greater tools and money to acquire and process information, but those that lack that information are the most vulnerable to these misinformation campaigns. And we've seen these campaigns proliferate over the last few elections. I think they're going to continue to get worse. And it's a worrisome feature, and there's not a clear way to regulate it, given the First Amendment, given concerns and that of how to differentiate misinformation from true information, right? Who's to be the judge of that, of those things? But it's one of those things that's playing into that passive voter suppression. It's not only the lack of information, it's the lack of accurate information about elections.
And Dan Ticanci, since Bertrall Ross raised the issue about the legality questions, you know, as well, because clearly direct misinformation and obvious lie isn't necessarily protected under the First Amendment, but this really has much more to do with issue obfuscation, emphasizing certain areas. There's a lot of gray area between what would be a lie that would be illegal versus something that's covered but is awfully inaccurate. Go ahead, please.
Sure. Well, you might be surprised. The U.S. Supreme Court has actually said that lying is protected speech. And it's really, really difficult to craft laws that are going to prohibit false speech in the context of electoral campaigns, unless it meets the legal definition of defamation, which is a very high standard, what's often referred to as actual malice. I don't really think that laws prohibiting false speech are how we are going to address the really serious problem of misinformation and disinformation in elections. The ways in which we will address this problem include, I think, for all of us, an insistence upon truth in political discourse and not accepting the rhetoric that we are somehow in a post-truth area right now. Democracy depends upon a shared commitment to truth and to the methodologies, including the legal method that we rely upon in our society for distinguishing what's true and what's false. And if you want to look for a bright spot from the last election, from the 2020 election, look at the fact that for all the misinformation and disinformation that was peddled during and after that election, the allies of former President Trump had no success peddling those lies in court, whether it was before Republican or Democratic aligned judges. Those false claims of massive electoral fraud got no traction in court. And that is a really favorable thing. I do believe that our courts, including both state and federal courts, could well wind up being, in the next election or subsequent election, the last line of defense. So it is encouraging that they stood up against the rampant falsehoods that we've seen in our electoral debate, even though those falsehoods have gotten currency, substantial currency, among a big component of the electorate.
And so, Bertrand Ross, you have also written about the role that gerrymandering, the partisan gerrymandering, the impact it has on voter turnout and certainly on voter representation. It's fair to say, no matter who controls Congress, particularly the House of Representatives, but both houses, Democrats are almost assuredly going to get more votes than Republicans did. How much is that contributing to voter disenfranchisement or forms of voter suppression?
Yeah, I was really worried at the beginning of the decennial, this redistricting. It seemed that the maps were going to be skewed very far in one direction because many of the state legislatures that draw district lines were controlled by Republicans, whereas the districts in more Democratic states, some of them were drawn by redistricting commissions and some were drawn by the state legislature or Democratic state legislatures. But it seemed like it was going to be skewed in favor of one party over the other, which has an extremely distortive effect because you end up having a seat composition that does not match the voting, the electorate in terms of their voting preferences. It doesn't seem that we've seen that effect, at least with this election. It's been rather unusual in the sense that the partisan balance that will result from this election in the Congress will, you know, be close to the electorate balance with respect to voting in the electorate, not precisely on, it'll slightly skew in favor of the Republican but not as far as I thought it would. What I think is most worrisome for me with respect to gerrymandering is the lack of competitiveness that results from some gerrymandering efforts. You see some states engage in gerrymandering that's not only designed to give them partisan advantage to the party of the legislature that draws the districts, but also designed to give them durable advantages in the sense of drawing districts that are rather safe for members of their party so that they will control them throughout the decade. We've seen this occur in places like Wisconsin and other places in terms of drawing these durable districts favoring one party over the other. And I still think that, you know, what studies have shown, they've been mixed in terms of the whether they have a demobilizing effect, because the problem is often there are statewide elections that are going on at the same time as district elections. So it's hard to tease out what the effects of these districting arrangements are. But what has been interesting to see in terms of where it could be studied in a state like Virginia, which I'm in, I have only one race that was on the ballot in my district, which was a congressional district race, in a district that was not competitive at all. And the turnout numbers reflect that in terms of relatively low turnout, because there's a sense that the vote doesn't really matter that much. You do it for your civic duty, but you do it not because you think your candidate that you favor is going to win or lose, because you know it's already preordained. And so we're seeing those effects more in a less systematized way when you don't have statewide elections. But that's kind of the biggest worry for me with respect to partisan gerrymandering, is just demobilizing effect.
And Dan Tukhanji, one of the breaks against that was always the federal government, that the states needing the federal government's at least oversight into whether it's, you know, districting or even, you know, certification, you know, of elections. I know that's on the Supreme Court docket. That would be a much more empowerment of the state, maybe even empowering the state legislature to pretty much do whatever they want without any sort of legal or federal challenge. How much of a threat is that?
I think it's a really big threat. So, you know, as Professor Ross was suggesting, gerrymandering really can and should be understood as a form of vote suppression, right? We usually think of vote suppression as laws that make it more difficult to vote, but it can also be laws that distort representation by giving one more party a lot more representation per vote than another. And, you know, we've actually seen some meaningful progress on this front in the last decade. There's a lot more public awareness of gerrymandering now than there was 10 years ago. A number of states have adopted changes to their laws, often through state constitutional amendments that make it more difficult for states to gerrymander. For example, in my former state of Ohio, the congressional districts last decade were really, really heavily gerrymandered. A plan was drawn at the beginning of the cycle in 2011 that gave Republicans 12 of 16 districts, three quarters of the districts, and that margin held throughout all of the last decade. Well, fast forward to a couple days ago, what actually happened is that Democrats were able to win 5 of 15 districts. A couple of those districts, at least, were pretty competitive. They were actually expected to be won by Republicans, but we got them. That's the result of a much more competitive districting plan, which is the result of these changes that were adopted to the Ohio Constitution over the last few years. So that's a favorable development. But as your question suggests, Doug, that's at risk right now. The Supreme Court has before it a case out of North Carolina, Moore versus Harper. The argument is really not just novel, but really quite revolutionary. It's the so-called independent state legislature theory. The idea that state legislative bodies, when they draw congressional districts, can't be constrained by state constitutions or by state courts interpreting their constitutions. I think most legal scholars believe that this idea is absolutely ridiculous, has no foundation in the Constitution or its history. And yet there's a real possibility that the Supreme Court will embrace this extraordinary theory, which would make it practically impossible for state courts to restrict partisan gerrymandering through interpretations of their own state's constitutions.
And Bertrand Ross, I'll give you then the last words on these. How much did this election and the responses to these voter suppression, voter intimidation, how much did we dodge that bullet and we should feel good about democracy going forward? And how fearful should we be that these issues are certainly not going to go away just because of one election, and the expectation that elections in 2024 and beyond are going to continue to raise these issues?
You know, I'm much more optimistic now than before the election about the future of American democracy. So I want to kind of start on that hopeful note. We're still not out of the woods. We still have dangerous seas in front of us that we have to navigate. But going back to, and this kind of relates to a point that Dean Tukhanji made just recently, in the sense that we don't necessarily won't know the effects of these laws for, you know, perhaps a few elections, right? we had an election that sparked a lot of interest in which people were passionate about and were going to do whatever they could to vote. And there was a lot of money put into these elections that led to a lot of canvassing and mobilization efforts that countered the effects of these restrictive laws. But what happens when the attention fades? What happens when there's not as much money focused on this? What happens when there's not as much of a counter mobilization effort? That's when the laws are going to have their most bite. And that's the future that I'm concerned about. So I don't think we've dodged the bullet yet, but to the extent that we have limited the possibilities with respect to election subversion, another thing that Dean Takagi was referring to earlier in the sense that the Secretary of States that did not believe in the 2020 election's legitimacy, most of them, if not all of them, seem to have lost their elections. So those who are in charge of elections seem to be people that believe in democracy and the legitimacy of our system. That's a hopeful sign. Voter suppression, the counter-mobilization efforts in response, that's a hopeful sign, but there's still danger ahead and we need to be constantly vigilant. And we need to sort of push back on these laws. There needs to be movements that are focused on repealing these unnecessarily restrictive laws to make elections as accessible as possible for the people.
One of the most positive developments in 2022 is that election deniers did not do very well. Many of them lost the elections. And so the lesson is perhaps the most effective tool we have to counter some of these anti-democratic movements is just popular mobilization and getting out and voting, an assertion of the need. If you want to protect your right to vote, you got to vote. And you got to vote based on that. And with that, I want to thank our guests. Our panel today have been Bertrall Ross. He is the Justice Thurgood Marshall Distinguished Professor of Law and Director of the Karsh Center for Law and Democracy at the University of Virginia. He's the author of Voter Data, Democratic Inequality, and the Risk of Political Violence, Passive Voter Suppression, Campaign Mobilization, and the Effective Disenfranchisement of the Poor, and Partisan Gerrymandering as a Threat to Multiracial Democracy. Dan Takagi is the Fred W. and Vi Miller Dean and Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin Law School. He's the author of True Threats, Voter Intimidation and the Constitution, Election Law, Democracy, and Legal Education, and the co-author of Election Law, Cases and Materials. And Jeremy Suri, professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs. He's the author of the very recently published book, Civil War by Other Means, and the host of the podcast, This is Democracy. Thank you very much for joining us.
When we come back, the dark side of democracy. What is it and when does it happen? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. On this post-election week, from our archives, we bring you this discussion on the dark side of democracy.
Democracy, the idea of governing of, for, and by the people, is a long exalted principle, particularly here in the U.S. But our next guest suggests that democracy may also have a dark side. He suggests that majorities can and do oppress minorities, often in the name of majoritarian democracy. In the worst case scenarios, this has led to murderous ethnic cleansing and ultimately genocide. We're joined now by Professor Michael Mann. Michael Mann teaches sociology at UCLA and has authored several books, including Sources of Social Power, Fascists, and the subject for today, The Dark Side of Democracy. Welcome, Michael Mann.
Thank you for having me, Maria.
Great to have you. So you open your book with historical figures who had allegedly embodied enlightened reason along the line of Thomas Jefferson, for example. And yet Thomas Jefferson and others justified exterminating entire peoples.
Yes, that's right. In fact, we find that with the settler colonies, we find the most direct relationship between democracy and ethnic cleansing, because the greater the level of democracy among the settlers, the more murderous they were towards the native populations. So North America and Australia are really the most exterminatory regimes as far as Native peoples are concerned, wiping out about 97% of the Native Americans of this landmass, and slightly less, 95% in Australia. And where imperial governments were stronger and more authoritarian, as in the Spanish Empire, for example, the death rate was less. So we do find people like Thomas Jefferson, the first governors of California, all urging people to get rid of the Indians. And even with almost all of the Native Americans gone, President Theodore Roosevelt declared that extermination was as ultimately beneficial as it was inevitable. So there is quite a history of this settlers who have pretty well-functioning forms of democracy for themselves being more murderous towards peoples that they define as aliens.
And the other thing I found quite interesting is that you say this phenomenon of ethnic cleansing and genocide, it's not really primitive or alien, it's a modern problem.
I think that the desire to get rid of a whole people is modern. Certainly we find many atrocities throughout history, but when we look at things like the atrocities committed by the Babylonians against the Jews, documented in the Old Testament, we see something else. We see them marching in, coming across the first Jewish city, demanding surrender, and if they don't surrender, they will all be killed, so say the Babylonians. They don't surrender, the Babylonians storm the city, they kill all the inhabitants. But that's a military tactic. That's supposed to get them, the other cities, to surrender. And of course, the other cities do. And this kind of practice was normal in earlier history, but the notion of wiping out a whole people is, I think, modern. And the basic reason for that is in previous periods, class distinctions were so great that rulers very rarely considered themselves to be part of the same people as the ordinary peasant. And so they didn't have a very ethnic conception of themselves. Elites in different societies thought of themselves as being closer to each other than they thought of being closer to the masses.
I would think that another reason for this would have to do with something else that you wrote about, which is oftentimes these ethnic cleansings occur when the minority, which may be oppressed, does not submit to the majority. But in the past, it seemed like there were more submissive, when it was more class-based, people submitted a little bit more.
Yes, it didn't matter very much to them whether they were being oppressed by the Jewish upper classes or the Babylonians. Today, there is far more of a common identity between the people and the leaders, and so you have ethnic bonding occurring across class. So, in a way, class conflict, class divisions are a protection against ethnic cleansing.
And which one is worse? Interesting.
Well, in terms of mass murder, I think there's no question that ethnic cleansing is generally the worst, though, of course, you do have these very particular things going on in Soviet Russia and in China, where landlords, kulaks, are slaughtered in very large numbers as enemy classes. But that's very rare.
And in Cambodia?
And in Cambodia, too, you're quite right. Yeah.
Right. One other statistic I thought was striking, and I don't know exactly how this really fits in with your whole thesis, is the civilian deaths in wars and conflicts that, say, in World War I, less than 10% of the deaths were civilian. World War II comes around, it was about half. And now the wars in the 90s, it's like 80% civilian deaths.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Now, how does this relate to the whole democratic argument?
I think that part of it relates, obviously, to new weapons of war and especially to aerial bombing. But it's certainly the case that we, the democracies, in winning World War II, for example, did engage in indiscriminate bombing. And I'm not thinking primarily of Hiroshima, which you can debate about that. It was supposed to end the war earlier, and it probably did. But I'm thinking more of the firebombing of Tokyo or Dresden, in which the American and British Air Force as well was deliberately targeting civilians in order to destroy the will of the Japanese and German people. Of course, it didn't really work. But there's no question, as far as the British were concerned, there was a strong element of revenge for German bombing of British cities. So democracies, it depends what you count as atrocities. Democracies, if you bring in wars, have been just as atrocious as anyone else.
Now, if we go into your theoretical arguments here, one of the things you distinguished, which I thought was quite interesting, are these two versions of we the people.
Yeah.
You have this liberal version that honors the individual, and one that you call organic or whole people that seems to be more about the entire community. Why don't you describe these concepts and give us some examples?
Yes. Well, there are two concepts of the people. There's two Greek origins, demos, from which we get the democracy words, and ethnos, from which we get ethnicity and ethnic cleansing. And now these are both words for the people, ruled by the people. And the problem comes when the two get confused. If you think of we the people in the United States, we the people actually meant white males. It was also something, also a political regime dominated by property owners. And so it didn't actually mean everybody. Whereas in the 19th and 20th century, it became much more likely that people, when talking about we the people, would mean absolutely everybody. And this became bound up with a form of nationalism, whereby everyone who was part of the same ethnic group was considered to have the same culture, the same soul. And that since there was a unitary group, a single ethnic group, the state had to represent that, and minorities could not be full members of this state, and so were discriminated against. As you said earlier, it's when the minorities resist that you get real trouble. The normal lot of minorities is to accept discrimination. Maybe they should if it leads to ethnic civil wars and ethnic cleansing.
You know, it's interesting. I was looking through your examples that you argued were evidence of this. And Rwanda, I would like to focus on Rwanda because I was thinking about the ethnic minority, which was the Tutsi people that were essentially annihilated in the genocide, were not really resisting the Hutu power that took the government after the president was assassinated. So can you explain that particular genocide in terms of resistance and laying claims to the same land? Obviously, the Hutu power wanted the land.
Yes.
But it seemed like there was something else to it. And the other thing I want you to address, you talk about how sometimes these genocides and ethnic cleansings are really a plan C, that they don't intend to be genocidal. And I was looking for evidence of this in Rwanda and couldn't quite find it. Can you explain?
Yes, that's two questions, yes. The Tutsis were only 15% of the population, but they were considered by the Belgians, Rwanda was part of their empire, were considered by the Belgians as the natural ruling group, the people with more power, with more abilities, and so they ruled through the Tutsis. And this strengthened the senses of ethnic identity. But in the last years of Belgian rule, there were pressures from Belgium and also from within Rwanda to do more for the Hutus. And after independence, the Hutus came to power. And Tutsis then felt disgruntled. Many of them left the country. Now, it isn't actually true, what you said, that there was no resistance, because there were two things that sparked off the genocide. One was the shooting down of the plane of the president, the Hutu president, presumably by Tutsis.
Yeah, I think that's presumably, though. There's some question about that.
We'll never know for sure, but the balance of probability is that it was indeed Tutsis. The second thing that was going on is there was a Tutsi invasion by the people who'd fled, the Tutsis who'd fled into neighboring Uganda, and they'd been helped by the Ugandan government.
Right, the Rwandan Patriotic Front.
That's right.
But these were not the residents of Rwanda. These were people who had been displaced before, who had come back.
That's right. That's
and
right.
wanted their land back.
Yes, they wanted to win a war and become the new government, and indeed they did. But it's true that the majority of the Tutsis in Rwanda were not resisting, but the Hutus came to believe that these Tutsis were helping the Tutsi invaders. There was a fierce battle going on within the Hutu community, and as a result of the invasion and then the shooting down of the president's plane, the Hutu extremists managed to come to seize power, and as soon as they seized power, they launched the genocide. Let me say that in these 20th century cases, like Rwanda, Yugoslavia, Armenia, these are not democracies doing it, but it is the problem of the democratization process. All of these groups who eventually perpetrated the genocide or ethnic cleansing in these cases were originally seeking a more democratic form of government. And it was when they began to confuse those two senses of democracy, of rule by the people, with a particular ethnic group, that it led towards these terrible atrocities. So I'm not saying in those cases that they were democracies. They obviously weren't, but that it was the democratizing process that led towards.
Is there something in the U.S. that kind of shows an oppressive quality of democracy, of majorities oppressing a minority? But it's not ethnic cleansing. It's just a violation of rights. Prop 8 is the example that I frequently look to, this or maybe in Prop 187 or some of these other propositions. And it really seems to be direct democracy that often is the violating of the minorities.
Yes, well, of course, what direct democracy, what referenda can do is whip up scares and against minorities who seem deviant, and you do get that in the propositions. But I think that, the kinds of terrible atrocities that I'm talking about are in a different league.
They're definitely in a different league.
And I think there is a bright side to what's going on. There is a steady progress of rights in this. Well, not completely steady, but the backlash is unlikely to prevail in the medium term, I would think, because it's clear that society is going in a more human rights direction.
Now, is that because of the kind of democracy that is established here in the United States?
Well, I think it's more general than that. I think that there are social processes going on across the Western world as a whole, and so you have the same kind of thing happening in Europe too now. It's not because there are not referenda in that way. It doesn't have the same drama involved as is the case in California, but there is an advance of these kinds of rights. And I'm not a specialist in this area, but it's obvious that there is a kind of sexual revolution going on and has been going on for some time, and that it partly came out of other human rights, civil rights movements, and that'll probably continue.
Michael Mann, I want to thank you so much for being with us. The book is called The Dark Side of Democracy, Explaining Ethnic Cleansing, and I know I took you a little off track there, and I apologize, but it is something that I've thought about in terms of the dangers of democracy at times whenever the general public decides to violate rights of another, and of course you're talking about the extreme version. But I would like to say thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you very much, Maria.
Michael Mann teaches sociology at UCLA and has authored several books, including Fascists and the subject for today, The Dark Side of Democracy.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seth Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org. And our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.